Welcome to the latest episode of The Peace Production, the podcast from the Organization for World Peace, where we examine current issues threatening human security. My name is Catherine Everest. Today, I am joined by Dr. Rodrigo Acuña, teacher, writer, and expert on Latin American politics, specializing in Venezuelan foreign policy. How has the US reacted to Iranian violations of economic sanctions against Venezuela? What other countries have gone against these economic sanctions? How does Venezuela's historical role within Latin America tie into its political crisis today? And what could foreign policy towards Venezuela look like under a new Biden presidency? These are all questions we will look into on today's show. Welcome to the podcast, Rodrigo. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Throughout Donald Trump's presidency, a multitude of actions have been taken in efforts to oust President of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. From supporting Juan Guaido in a coup d'etat attempt, to charging Maduro for drug trafficking, can you talk us through what happened in one of the later failed intervention attempts headed by CEO of Silvercorp USA, Jordan Goodreau?
Certainly. Well, this was a botched covert operation by a paramilitary organization, which can be contracted from the United States. Basically, they were under the illusion that as soon as they arrived, a force of maybe a couple hundred men coming over from Colombia in the next couple of hours would be enough for the Venezuelan military to crack and support them and overthrow the government of Nicolas Maduro. Now, what we have seen in the last few years, in fact, after 2002, when there was a brief coup d'etat against President Hugo Chavez, is that the Venezuelan military has actually behaved quite professionally and unified around the existing government. So while there have been sections which have considered or even attempted to carry out or plot a coup d'etat, they are still in the absolute minority. I think it's actually almost surprising, given the considerable pressure that they are under. So once these mercenaries arrived from Colombia, they were actually captured by local police forces and fishermen and sympathizers of the revolution. And basically the show was over. They then were arrested and appeared on parts of their trial appeared on Venezuelan TV. And they considered that they were under the illusion or the misinformation that the vast majority of the Venezuelan armed forces would actually join them in overthrowing the government.
I guess maybe not the best assumption to make. The US Treasury has imposed economic sanctions punishing individuals and companies within and outside of the US who participate in the trade of oil with Venezuela, specifically state-owned oil company PDVSA. Iran has gone against sanctions by delivering petrol to the ports of Venezuela, and as far as I know, the latest delivery was set to be made just before elections were held in Venezuela on the 6th of December. How many deliveries has Iran made and how has the US reacted to these?
The specific number I actually couldn't tell you. I know that there are several ships that have arrived in Venezuela. I think two or three ships may have even been captured by the US Navy. But the amount of trade that's taking place between the two countries is basically helping Venezuela stay afloat. Venezuela, although it is historically one of the largest oil producers, when Venezuelan oil was nationalized in mid-1970s, the transition or the nationalization that took place was in such a manner that it actually worked closely in collaboration with US oil companies. So there were agreements that were made that once the nationalizations took place, US capital was not going to be seriously threatened. Now, part of those nationalizations meant that refineries of Venezuelan oil were actually based, they were already based, but they actually continued to build more refineries in the United States. So Venezuela has the problem that it has very thick crude oil. Once it gets it out of the ground, it actually needs to be refined. And those refineries, although there are some in Venezuela, the majority are actually in the United States. So they have a logistical problem. And I think it's an example of a wider problem that many Latin American countries have, where far too much of their historical trade is with the United States. And is based on rather unequal terms. So when left-wing or progressive or even administrations that might not even be part of those political tendencies arrive to gain power, as soon as the United States decides that they're not quite happy with them, they can then immediately start exerting vast amounts of economic pressure on them.
And for years, the US has claimed intervention in Venezuela is aimed at ousting Maduro due to his alleged activity in illegal gold mining, human rights abuses, drug trafficking, and corruption in state-operated oil operations. What are your views on US intervention in Venezuela, and what do you believe is the end goal of the US?
Well, I think the end goal of the US, for the US, is to overthrow the Maduro administration and what the Venezuelans or supporters of the government historically call the Bolivarian Revolution. The United States historically has been completely, completely incapable of coexisting with progressive, let alone left-wing governments in Latin America. That goes back to the CIA-backed coup d'etat in Guatemala in the early 1950s. You move through the government in Brazil in the 1960s, Allende in Chile, and then the Sandinistas in Nicaragua in the 1980s. Now, in terms of Maduro and his people, certainly there are elements that are corrupt. There's probably more corruption within the Maduro administration than there was under the Chavez government. That shouldn't be doubted. Venezuela, prior to Hugo Chavez becoming president in 1999, had one of the highest indicators for corruption within Latin America. So it was already one of the most corrupt countries within the region to begin with. So let's, you know, be clear about that. There certainly is corruption within the Maduro administration. But if the United States were actually serious about clamping down on human rights and or violators of human rights, people, members of governments that are dealing with drug cartels, I mean, they could begin with Mexico. Mexico, for the last 20, 30 years, every Mexican president has pretty much come to power through the support of cartel drug money. The same can be said for Colombia and certainly the case in Honduras. In Colombia, in fact, if you Google Álvaro Uribe, he was closely connected to Pablo Escobar, and the evidence against him is absolutely, it's massive. I mean, the Congress has tried to take him down. He was placed under house arrest. To give you one more example, if we go to Panama in the 1980s, there was a progressive general that took power in the late 1970s, and he actually negotiated with the Carter administration in terms of the Panama Canal, having the Panama Canal returned back to Panamanian sovereignty. That president, his aeroplane blew up in midair. It's long been suspected that he was assassinated. The general that took over, General Manuel Noriega, everyone knew was involved in the drug trade. Everyone knew that he was linked with the CIA and was supporting the Contras that were trying to topple the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. So he was not a problem. Noriega was not a problem for the Bush senior administration when he was working with them. When his ego got the better of him and he thought that he could stay in power a little bit longer, then all of a sudden the US media realized paid attention to the fact that he was involved in the drug trade. So it was very easy to pin a case against him. With regards to Venezuela, it's much harder to actually do that because Maduro and several of his key advisors are people that are directly linked or from the administration of Hugo Chavez. And Hugo Chavez was actually a politician that was driven by ideology. Whether you agree or you disagree with his ideology, the opposition tried many times to highlight, pinpoint that he was involved in corruption, and it actually wasn't the case. So I think these charges are certainly politically motivated. But again, I would not dismiss the fact that, yes, there are elements within the administration that, are probably corrupt.
Yeah. And when you say politically motivated and you recognize Hugo Chavez's ideologies, would you say politically motivated to try and stop the spread of ideology, which goes against essentially what the US stands for?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Because not only did Chavez start as a sort of a radical progressive, Chavez, after the 2002 coup d'etat, moved further left and then established a strategic alliance with Cuba and began to fund and promote regional organizations, which eventually became a problem for the United States
which is dangerous for their influence in the region, which leads nicely into the next question. How significant is Venezuela regionally within the Americas, and does its standing within the region have anything to do with the way the US has treated it in the past and continues to treat it?
Well, when oil prices were high, Venezuela certainly had a lot of influence. When the price of oil was, I think it almost peaked at close to $150 a barrel, Venezuela was bankrolling regional organizations and lobbying South American countries to join it and try and establish alternative economic agreements more based along the line of being able to barter with each other and trying to move around utilizing US currency or the euro. So up until 2014, 2015, Venezuela certainly had a lot of influence within America. Historically, it's always been a mid-ranking power. But again, because of the high price of oil and the visibility that Chavez had, it was certainly exercising a lot of influence. That's far less the case today. Venezuela is barely holding on. Serious economic problems, serious pressure from US sanctions. So that is far less the case today. What concerns the United States and how Venezuela is perceived on a regional level is certainly its policies. So the fact that the administration has continued to invest in a housing program and has actually built more houses for the poor than any other government in South America, probably in the last 40 years, is of course embarrassing. The fact that Venezuela has attempted to, or maybe has, eliminated literacy, the fact that Venezuela has agreements with Cuba where close to 30,000 Cuban doctors and nurses and medical experts are in the country providing healthcare is again embarrassing to other Latin American countries. The fact that Venezuela has begun to invest in its sports people and obtain medals and gold medals, etc., sporting achievements throughout the region is again something that embarrasses other governments. Cuba, for example, country 11 million people, blockaded for close to or over 60 years by the United States, they clean up at the Olympics when it comes to sporting achievements. Now, there's a reason for that. They actually invest in their sports people. For all of the problems that they have and the contradictions that they have, those social policies, many within Latin America would argue that are precisely ones that are needed.
Yeah, and if there's a country that's able to successfully do that and then try and be a leader within the region, then you do understand why the US would see that as a threat. In your view, what is domestic and regional support like for Maduro in comparison to a US-backed leadership, as well as continuing socialist policies or left policies versus a likely introduction of more capitalist policies should US-backed leadership be installed?
Well, now we are still within the era of right-wing governments have come to power. There was a period there from about 2005, 2006 onward, till about 2013, 14, 15, where most governments in Latin America were actually either center-left progressive governments or left-wing governments, trading with Venezuela, becoming part of the Bolivarian Alliance for the Americas, engaging in all sorts of activities, which of course US administrations did not approve of. The problem or what has taken place since then is of course that there were governments that there were elements that were involved in corruption. You had political exhaustion as well, and some of these governments lost office. So you saw a return of the right. Now, the right, I think, has not been intelligent in being able to use the political capital it gained once it won office. So take, for example, Argentina. Argentina under Macri almost immediately went back to harsh neoliberal economic policies. So, I mean, he lasted one term. If there's an example of mismanaging an economy and not paying attention to the reason why the Kirchners came to power and were able to win office for so many years, it's Macri in Argentina. Bolsonaro in Brazil has been a complete disaster when it comes to COVID, openly making comments and siding with the former fascist military regime in Brazil. We call him the Latin American Trump. And there is a reason for that. So his ratings in the polls are very low. So if you're looking at support for Venezuela on a regional level from governments, certainly there are governments in Latin America that want to have nothing to do with Maduro. And they're in fact openly working with the United States to try and overthrow him. On a popular base, those opinions differ from country to country. So in Cuba, as it's a strategic ally of Venezuela, they support Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador. So you have to go sort of country by country level to examine the situation. And of course, politics in Latin America is quite volatile. So right now we're still seeing right-wing governments in power. Fast forward to, you know, into the future, we might see a return of the left in Latin America. It's actually looking like it's heading in that direction.
And domestically, if do you think if citizens had to choose between Maduro or a US-backed leadership, how do you feel like that would go?
Well, the elections that just took place in Venezuela, the governing PSUV and the coalition, the Polo Patriotico Coalition, won close to 70% of seats in the National Assembly. Now, voter turnout was incredibly low, probably one of the lowest in many years, about 30%. But there, again, there are reasons for that. The country is literally falling apart because of harsh economic sanctions, which, according to various organizations, United Nations investigation, I think about 2 years ago, concluded that there was something like about 100,000 people that have actually died due to sanctions in Venezuela. The Center for Economic and Policy Research in the United States a few years ago gave a figure of 40,000 people. It's certainly in the tens of thousands of people that are now dying in Venezuela because of lack of access to medical equipment, medicines, which historically have been imported from the United States. So support for Maduro is certainly low. The problem that the opposition has within Venezuela, though, is that with the exception of Enrique Capriles in the 2013 elections, is that they have never been able to present a viable project which is going to appeal to the 50, 60% of people that historically are a part of the marginalized, the lower classes, the working class. Those people have never felt attracted to an opposition in Venezuela, which historically, with the exception of Guaido, there's even a racial difference between them. Venezuelan elites, like most elites in Latin America, historically are of European heritage. There's an element of, a serious element there of racism as well. So the fact that when Chavez won the elections in 1989, assumed power in 1999, he made many Venezuelans feel proud of their indigenous and Afro heritage. So that's something that has affected the psychology of many Venezuelans, in particular, the ones that strongly identified with his political project. So support for Maduro is low, but I think that the opposition will have to seriously reconsider many of its positions in order to be able to defeat Maduro successfully in an election.
And returning to Iran, Venezuela and Iran have historical political ties. Under Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's presidency from 2005 to 2013, he stated, "When the Western countries were trying to isolate Iran, we went to the US backyard," referring to Venezuela and neighboring countries where he opened new embassies. More recently, in November of this year, Iran's foreign minister traveled to Caracas to begin a tour of Latin America, where he also visited Cuba and Bolivia. How strong have Iranian-Venezuelan ties been in the past, and how strong are they now?
Well, let's again be clear in terms of Iran. It is a theocracy. It is a government which is quite distant in many regards to Venezuela and the Latin American left. There are people within the Latin American left that have said, how can Venezuela have an alliance with a country that actually imprisons trade union leaders and persecutes people that are part of the political left? And I think those criticisms need to be listened to. The fact that this alliance trade takes place, I think, is a reflection of the harsh reality that Venezuela finds itself in. If we go back into the era of the Cold War. It wasn't Sweden or India or Bangladesh that was going to save the Cuban Revolution. The Cuban Revolution was only going to survive if it sided with the Soviet Union. The amount of pressure within Cuba for Castro to engage in vast nationalizations was massive. Castro had not done that. He might have even been overthrown himself by other sections of his movement. So when the left has come into power in Latin America, it has had to go global because there's almost no compromise with even Democrats within the United States. Castro actually tried that just after the triumph of the revolution, even before he sided with the Soviet Union, called himself a socialist. He actually traveled to the United States, tried to have meetings. Eisenhower did not meet him. He actually sent the vice president, who was Richard Nixon at the time. So the Latin American left understands that. They understand that they need to go global, and they become very pragmatic in that sense. In terms of a major alliance taking place, look, I think it's overrated. I really do. I think it's a matter of Venezuela simply trying to survive. There are some exchanges in technology, but I think that the alliance between Venezuela and China and Venezuela and Russia is far more important than the alliance with Iran.
And then when you say Venezuela is forced to reach out globally, I guess in reaching out to China and Russia, they're the two major powers that are up against the US. So in November, Venezuela recommenced shipping oil direct to China after the two countries ceased trade in August of 2019 due to US sanctions. How does this play into the Venezuelan-US narrative, especially considering the US's strained relationship with China at the moment?
Well, Trump's hostile position and trade war with China, I think, has favoured certain governments within Latin America that have wanted to establish closer ties with China. So China might have strategically pulled back in some of its trade with Venezuela, but that was really, I think, to reorder the house before it recommenced again. China has actually lent Venezuela vast amounts of money. It's refinanced loan after loan, huge loans. So I think that alliance is actually quite strong. And it's one where, in contrast to the trade agreements that have taken place between Latin American countries and US companies, administrations in Washington, there has always been a problem with a transfer of technology. So a manufacturing company will arrive in Latin America. They'll say, look, we'll set up a local car manufacturing industry. But there's no transfer of technology. The agreements that Latin American countries have had with the United States have been very different to the agreements that the US has established with countries like, say, South Korea or Taiwan, where there have been transfers of technology. So Latin American countries that understand this, administrations within Latin America that understand this, have tried to engage in trade with China and have done so in, I would say, better terms than they have with the United States.
And moving on to Russia, business ties exist between the Venezuelan oil industry and Russian-owned oil company Rosneft. In March this year, Rosneft sold its Venezuelan-based assets to the Russian government to avoid US sanctions targeting private companies. What could this mean for the Venezuelan-US narrative, again, considering the US's strained relationship with Russia?
Again, I think it's just a matter of Russia retreating strategically to reorder the house because of hostilities with the Trump administration. Russia, in fact, is the main provider of Venezuelan weapons. Colombia had a civil war that raged for 40, 50 years. Massive sections of the country were controlled by left-wing rebels. And Venezuela under Chavez took the position that there should be a negotiated agreement between the rebels and the Colombian state. That eventually actually took place, despite the fact that the rebels were, you know, had engaged in human rights violations, not the nicest guys in the world, but they had a base in the country that supported them because of some real grievances. So taking those positions regionally, the United States began to curtail its sales of parts for Venezuela's fighter jets, which were actually US made. So Venezuela needed to start looking for allies internationally. And eventually it was the Russians and I think Belarus that substituted Venezuelan military hardware. So there's a strong alliance and ties there between Venezuela and Russia. I don't see those ties coming to an end in the foreseeable future, unless, of course, the Maduro government loses power through elections or is overthrown.
So on that same note, it almost seems there is an anti-US alliance sort of being formed between Venezuela, Iran, Russia and China. What could this mean for Venezuela and Venezuelan foreign policy into the future? And conversely, what could this mean for US foreign policy into the future regarding Venezuela?
I don't think there is the framework of an alliance aimed strategically at the United States on behalf of Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Venezuela has been far more interested in establishing regional organizations within South America and within Latin America, and has been more interested in establishing greater trade with Latin American countries and winning diplomatic battles within the Americas. But certainly these alliances, trade, political and military, do exist. There were sections within both armed forces, I'm talking about the Russian and the Venezuelans, that wanted to have a Russian base within Venezuela. That has never been given the green light from Moscow. So I don't think we can talk about an alliance being formed. I think really it's a situation quite similar to Cuba during the Cold War, of simply wanting to survive and looking for international allies which will allow the government within Venezuela to do that.
And even before Trump, the Bush administration backed a coup d'etat attempt against then-president Hugo Chavez, and Obama imposed sanctions against the country, declaring Venezuela a threat to US national security. How do you believe foreign policy towards Venezuela could look under a Biden presidency? And do you feel he will take as aggressive stance as Donald Trump has?
I think pressure within certain progressive elements within the Democrats will push Biden to retreat with the economic blockade. I think relations between Venezuela and the United States could not reach a lower point. Trump, short of actually sending in the Marines, has tried just about everything to try and overthrow the administration in Caracas. So I don't think the situation can be worse. Unfortunately, as I said before, both political parties within the United States, whether the Democrats or the Republicans, have a real problem with the Latin American left, whether it's a progressive government like Arbenz in the 1950s, agrarian reforms. They almost immediately side with local elites. And for the local elites, when progressive leftist governments come to power, they have a major ally. They have a superpower that can support them. So these conflicts, they're not able to be resolved internally. We live here in Australia. You have a Labor government in power, one or two terms, and then the Liberals and the coalition come to power. They sort of move back and forth, maybe more towards one way than the other. But we do have more of a functioning social democracy. That's not the case in Latin America. I mean, in Latin America, the right to simply have a trade union has been fought for tooth and nail, often with large massacres of trade union leaders taking place. So it's quite unfortunate that that is not understood broadly within the United States, because I think most Latin Americans want to coexist and live in peace with the United States, have a constructive relationship with the United States. The United States has certainly provided and given the world many interesting and wonderful things. But unfortunately, in terms of its foreign policy and in terms of its economic policies towards Latin America, I don't think they have been, overwhelmingly positive.
And when you speak of a regional alliance, so I guess if you think about it, there's Bolivia, Cuba, Venezuela, Ecuador, Nicaragua, who are sort of closer to the left, with maybe Brazil and Argentina having a slight shift towards the left. Do you think we will ever see the success of a left alliance within the Americas capable of taming the influence of the US within the region?
Very difficult. Unfortunately, it's very difficult because of the internal dynamics of each country. So that means that, again, almost every time that a progressive government has come to power, they've almost immediately have had to engage in very tough negotiations with the local business community, which has not wanted to negotiate with them. During the height of what was known as the pink tide in Latin America, many hard right political parties moved to the background, But that's because they lost so much prestige. They had supported harsh free market economics. Argentina was one of the most developed, if not the most developed country in South America. And it was basically chopped up and sold off during the Menem era in the 1990s. So they lost a lot of prestige and a lot of popular support, but controlling vast sections of the media in those countries, they were able to hack away at these administrations. They also won many elections. I've often said that if open, free and fair elections had been held during the Cold War in Latin America, the left would have become sick of winning elections because they, for all of their problems and contradictions, have presented social programs which are desperately needed in the region. So that is a situation that I don't think is going to change anytime soon. The internal contradictions of each country mean that, again, every time there are presidents that genuinely attempt to change things, the obstacles that they come up against are massive, massive.
And finally, currently in Venezuela, there are severe shortages of food and medical supplies, as you mentioned earlier. An estimated 4.5 million civilians have fled the country, while in 2019, it was estimated by the US mission to the UN agencies that 96% of Venezuelans were living in poverty. Do you believe these conditions can be attributed more so to the actions taken by Maduro's administration or to sanctions imposed by the US?
I think that the current problems that Venezuela has are problems that are historical. I think that the coup d'etat that took place against Chavez in 2002 pretty much set the agenda of everything that has happened since within Venezuela. So often some people that look at Latin America will know about the coup d'etat in 2002, but they forget or are unaware that shortly after there was a strike, what's called a manager's lockout strike, that lasted almost 3 months. This was the upper echelon of the oil company, the state oil company within Venezuela, that in order to try and overthrow Chavez, simply shut down their oil production and locked out their workforce. Those battles have continued. They haven't stopped within Venezuela. Often the government will tell or will say to the business community, look, I'm willing to work with you, give you tax breaks, here are some loans. They'll take the money. And then when it comes time to actually work with the government or fulfill their contracts, they don't actually do that. So that is an ongoing problem. Fast forward the story. If we look at the situation a few years ago, there was a dip in oil prices. So when oil prices were incredibly high, Venezuela talked about and in some ways attempted to diversify its economy. This happened under Chavez, agreements with China, with Iran, with Russia, creation of local mobile phone companies. There were some interesting projects that took place. Unfortunately, they weren't enough to diversify the economy. With high oil prices, Venezuela once again fell into the trap of becoming dependent on its oil exports. So once the price dropped, Maduro had a serious problem. I do think, as I said before, that elements of corruption within the government are far higher than they were under Chavez. Maduro, unfortunately, has never commanded the sort of respect or being as a figure that's as inspirational for his base as Chavez was. Chavez was a very shrewd political actor. He was often able to engage in the style of rhetoric which would place almost fear into the hearts of the Venezuelan elites, that if they did not try and work with him, if they really wanted to pursue the path of trying to overthrow his administration and, you know, implement a sort of a Pinochet brutal fascist dictatorship, well, he was going to bring the house down. He was going to go 1959 Cuban style revolution, complete, you know, full nationalization of the economy. And that would actually scare them. Again, I don't think Maduro has that ability, that political ability. So he has surrounded himself with people that he trusts. You have to remember, I mean, there was an assassination attempt against Maduro with drones only about a year and a half ago. Those attempts to overthrow his administration are real. You know, in Latin America, when the political left lose power, they don't get to retire in a nice villa. They are assassinated or lined up and shot in stadiums. That's something that they are aware of. And finally, the sanctions. The sanctions are real. So for the economic mismanagement which has taken place within the country, the sanctions are aimed at creating hardship within the population and creating hardship to the point where the base of the Maduro administration, the Bolivarian Revolution, the people in the working class areas and the slums and progressive sectors of the middle class that have been strong supporters of the political project. The objective is to demoralize them, to impoverish them to the point where they take to the streets and they overthrow the government. The fact that elections recently took place within Venezuela, the fact that four ex-presidents in Latin America and the ex-Spanish prime minister arrived in Venezuela, no international media coverage about this, the fact that there were over 1,200 international electoral observers, the fact that respected Latin American electoral observers were within the country, none of that received coverage. The United States immediately said that they weren't going to recognize or that conditions did not exist within Venezuela for elections to take place, and the European Union followed suit. So elections haven't taken place according to Brussels and Washington, but they have. And even though there was a very low voter turnout, again, I think that the political longevity, the sympathy that the Chavez administration had within vast sectors of the population, and the very real achievements that were succeeded within the country, lowering of poverty, increasing healthcare and education, these are things that people are still aware of. But yes, the situation is quite critical. And Venezuela is up against the ropes, so to speak.
And it's almost like with the elections, given there was only a 30% voter turnout, are Venezuelans thinking, well, who is the better option here? There's no point in voting. I'm happy to just let Maduro get voted back in because I don't feel like there's a viable alternative right now. What could an alternative be here? As I said,
unfortunately, the one alternative that might emerge is a section within Chavismo that has become critical of the elements of corruption within the government. And they have attempted now to form a coalition. And maybe this coalition in the future might be the ones that might succeed. But again, this is a Latin American country, not the smallest country in Latin America, historically a middle-ranking power. When a middle-ranking power goes up against a global superpower, you can almost determine who the winner is going to be. I'll give you just a brief example of Nicaragua in the 1980s. Nicaragua was ruled by the Somoza family, brutal thugs, three presidents from the same family, the father and two of his sons. In Nicaragua, if you were a trade union leader in the 1920s, Somoza I proudly would tell his visitors at his presidential palace, he would take them to his zoo and he would show them, you know, the elephants and tigers. And then he'd show them the local trade union leader that had been arrested. Complete psychopath. If we fast forward to the sons would have their death squads throw people into volcanoes, engage in all sorts of horrific torture. Now, the opposition to the Somoza dictatorship was so huge in Nicaragua that almost the entire population rebelled in 1979 and overthrew him. The hatred was so much that left-wing rebels tracked him down in Paraguay and blew his car up and assassinated him. Fast forward the story a little bit further. Elections were held in Nicaragua in the early 1980s. They were recognized by the European Union. They were recognized by many countries around the world. Washington, of course, refused to do that under the Reagan administration. But the National Guard, the military that had been the backbone of the dictatorship, they moved to Honduras and created a counter-war against the Sandinistas. Now, they wouldn't actually engage in warfare against the Sandinista standing army. They would go and attack peasants and villages. They would kill local Cuban doctors. They would kill human rights workers. And the objective was to bleed the country dry. It was to create political exhaustion. They did that. When we get to 1990 and people are again having to vote, people would actually write on the ballots, I support the Sandinistas, I support the revolution, but I can't take this war anymore. So I'm voting for the opposition. Now, that period of Latin American history, the 1980s, 1979 up until 1990, cost the lives of roughly 40,000 Nicaraguans. So there is a breaking point for many people in Venezuela. That's certainly the case. And what infuriates me is that the mainstream media is not covering these brutal sanctions or even contextualizing how the United States has behaved once again, to the, you know, in the same manner, to the point of boredom, with every left-wing or progressive administration in the region. They are incapable of coexisting with
it. It begs the question, will it ever end, or is this just going to keep happening and happening and happening?
Maybe a question for another podcast.
Maybe a question for another podcast, yes. Again, thank you so much, Rodrigo, for sharing your expertise with us. And to those listening, thank you for joining us on the latest episode of The Peace Production, the podcast presented by the Organization for World Peace. If you enjoyed the content and would like to hear more analysis by Rodrigo on Latin America, tune into his newly launched podcast in partnership with Alborada, Latin America Uncovered, called Indestructible Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. I'm Catherine Everest. Thanks again.